Gentlemen, thanks for being up here. Why don't we kind of start with the same thing, business model, and when you got started, what's your current business model, and when you got started. Oops, you only have one? Oh, I was going to say, should be two.
I got started in...
what's your name, Silvio?
Silvio Brigliadoro.
Okay.
It was back in 2007, really started exploring this real estate thing back in 2006. I was running a couple of businesses and it used to be very competitive. I had, I would adapt and modify my business and it was just fun. But towards the end, it was really, really, I started to realize that I did not enjoy what I was doing anymore. And of course, like somebody just said, voices in your head, sometimes it's better something that you know and you're familiar with than change. So kind of stuck to that for some time. But in 2006, I guess I really got to the point where I really disliked it, almost to the point where it was just disgust. I just didn't want to deal with it. And I think one of the things that really made an impact was that my daughter was born, and she was born at probably about 3 months too soon.
Oh.
And she was something like a pound or a pound and a half. And so obviously, it was an ICU, and that was a very life awakening moment. And I think that's where I realized that believe in something is very important. And just all of a sudden, like magic, I transitioned from not making a change to all of a sudden trying to explore new options. And,
okay.
And that, I think that made a big impact. Realizing that, I believed in something, everything turned out great, and so it was going to be the same thing with my career.
What do you do in the business right now? Are you in the buying and selling, buying, holding?
All of that.
All of that, okay.
Yeah, I consider myself, primarily, the two areas that I really enjoy in the business is buying and property management.
Okay.
I really enjoy those two areas. I guess I haven't had too many bad tenants yet, so.
Okay. All right, Steve?
My name's Steve Landis. My dad and I worked together, and we started in 2008 in the fix and flip business. And in 2008, we paid a lot of taxes, so we thought there's a better way. So we really got an affinity to landlording. And I'm based in Rancho Cucamonga, so we own about 150 houses and 100 apartment doors in Rancho Cucamonga. So mostly a landlord now. We fix and flip for down payment money, pretty much.
Okay. And are you making any conversion to commercial?
Yeah, we bought a couple commercial buildings this year, so we're doing that as well.
Okay. And your dad is a partner? Now, he had a commercial background?
Yeah, my dad has a new construction and commercial background, and we both kind of started in the California market. He was from Canada. Or we were both from Canada, so we started in the California commercial market originally.
Okay.
He started in the Canadian commercial market.
Okay. All right. Rick?
My name's Rick Solis. I bought my first rental house in 1988 when Steve was three.
Are you asking why you're on the panel?
Yeah. Why am I on that young guy's panel?
Is that a backhand?
Steve was three. He was watching Sesame Street while I was painting my house. I couldn't
put you on the old guy's panel, so I didn't know what to do with you.
Yeah, I'm in the
middle. Couldn't put you on the women's panel either. Just seemed like the best alternative.
My business partner is Andrea, who just spoke. And I've done a lot of buying, fixing, and selling over the years. And I've noticed, I learned early on that selling them retail really quickly, I was giving away 40% of my profits to the tax man. So I don't like to buy, fix, and sell. when I do sell it, I always want it to be like a year and a day. So I'm either paying 15% federal, 9% state, or I have the ability to 1031. Most of my stuff is in an IRA now, so I don't pay any taxes until I withdraw the money. And what was the rest of the questions?
I think you've covered about everything. Got a question for you that I didn't ask, though.
Okay.
Unusual that a partnership works as well as you.
Yes. She's very tenacious and gets the deals closed and gets to the finish line. And I've always really studied real estate for many years, and I had all the knowledge, and I always did a few deals, but I get kind of frustrated with the deal, and I'm always ready to just tap out. I'm done with this thing. And I'm ready to tap out every day. Like, let's sell these. I'm so over this.
Are you excited about management?
No. But she didn't have a clue how to buy a house in the beginning. And before her, I'm buying like one deal every 6 months. And then I convince her to go to your boot camp. And then before I know it, we're buying like two and three deals a month, you know. And I'm doing two deals a year before that. So a lot of it was her tenacity just to get to the finish line. And I think that was why the partnership worked out well. I mean, everything that I lack, she has. And everything she's lacking, I have. And it just works out really well.
Okay.
And she's literally, if the glass is almost empty, she's saying, no, that sucks, just a little bit till it's full. And I'm the opposite. I want to be like that. I struggle to be that guy every day. But if there's just a little bit missing, I'm like, that thing's almost empty. What are you talking about? And that every day I want to be more like her or you or Mike or Tony. And I want to be that half full guy, but I'm always the half empty guy. But it works out. The half empty thing has saved us from many, many problems. Because I look at, okay, this can go wrong and that can go wrong. And in spite of all that, we should do the deal. And, you know, that saved us from some deals that we shouldn't have done.
Okay. All right. And Doug?
Doug Van Soest. I'm a partner with my wife, Andrea. We run the business together.
Which he mentioned often on the... I just thought that was interesting. You could tell that was really a team. And I just hadn't heard that repetitively. So
yeah, I mean, absolutely wouldn't be doing, you know, we wouldn't be doing the business if it wasn't us together.
Just so you know, there's no perfect model, because I was happy not to have Marcia involved in the business all the time, because I didn't necessarily want to come home and discuss, you know, the break-ins and anything like that when you're doing a lot of houses. So, you know, different people do this successfully, but since you mentioned it kind of repetitively, I realized you were all into it together.
Yeah, and we'll go out on dates, and you know, we talk real estate, and we love it. And I'm fortunate in that way. You know, we can talk about that kind of thing.
When I used to be on vacation, you know, and I was really hot into it, you know, I'd drive by and I'd see tall grass, you know, and I didn't even have to be in California, and my neck would turn. And go, it's just a habit, you know, you say, oh, there's equity, you know.
But we bought our first house to flip in 2008, same time as Steve did. And I was an appraiser before that, and so I kind of had that background. And we fix and flip for a living still. We like to eat, so that's what we do, to eat and have a house and pay bills. And but we've been collecting rentals along the way, too. So now we have 52 units that we manage.
Just a couple, huh?
Yeah, got a couple, and very grateful for that, and it's worked out really well, even though it has been difficult at times. I'm glad we bought those along the way.
And what year did you get in the business?
2008.
Okay.
End of 2008.
So three very new people. Now, what's interesting about that, and this is really true, when you get into the business in a certain year, you're sort of tainted, maybe not the right word, but you kind of get a sense that this is always the way it works. So when you guys got in the business, it was REO heaven, you know, but prices were descending really hard. So you have one picture of it, and then all of a sudden you get to 2013, and the deals are probably not there nearly as much. They've moved, and, you know, like Mike said, the cheese was moved, and you kind of have to make some changes. What was the best asset you brought into the real estate business? Okay, Sylvia?
I think it was all the experience that I had doing all the other things that were completely unrelated to real estate. I didn't realize that at first, but once I'm, you know, doing the business, I'm realizing that a lot of it, you know, I think everyone here has a huge portion of all you need to really be in this business. You just have to see what, you know, what side of you, you know, fits the business, and what you can't do, you should find somebody else that would do it. And I think that was the biggest asset, just being able to find those things. And I think on the first question, I went blank for a minute. and I do the same thing, fix and flip. And that's primarily, my model is primarily, you know, buying properties, fixing, selling, creating the cash that I need to purchase more rentals.
Okay.
And so just keep adding on rentals as I go along.
What was the, like, the weakness when you came that you had to either fix yourself or delegate?
Well, my weakness has always been, you know, what Tony Alvarez has. I don't have the ability to really connect to people immediately. You know, it takes some time. So I think the asset that I have is that I realize my limitations. So I try to find, you know, ways around my limitations to be able to accomplish whatever it is that I have to do.
Okay.
So.
All right, Steve.
I think my greatest strength is the ability to learn something I don't know. So in 2008, there was a lot of new items, and you can figure it out by asking guys here or your escrow officer. So I was really good at figuring out what I didn't know and how to figure out how to solve the problem.
And the weakness that you brought?
Oh, that's easy. I don't like spending money I don't have. We did that a lot. So we'd commit $200,000, and we had $5,000 in the bank account. So.
Did we know that when we lent you all that money?
I don't know.
Okay, Rick.
I think my greatest asset, I probably have two for real estate, is I'm a real estate appraiser, and I've been a real estate appraiser since I bought that first house in 1988 and paid way too much money for it. Like a year later, I became an appraiser, so that wouldn't happen again. So I can figure out what stuff is worth, and I've seen so many different situations over the years. I can usually figure out the solution to get the problem solved. That's been my probably my best assets. And what was the other one? What's my weakness?
Yeah. What would you say was your weakest one?
My weakest one is I don't like drama, and with rental properties comes lots of drama. If you buy in the lower income blue collar areas that I tend to buy in, because those are the areas that have the most upside. Kind of like Tony's market. I mean, there's just tons of drama with those tenants and their lifestyles. And so that's a problem for me. If you're buying the nicer stuff that Mike has, like the Huntington Beach stuff, I mean, that drama's not there and you don't have to deal with it. But I don't like to deal with drama, and that's hard for me. Yeah, that's why I'm literally willing to sell it. You know, if I have a bad day, it's like, man, tomorrow those houses are leaving my world. And I will tap out that quick. So I've been that motivated seller. And I do understand, you know, that too, you know, why they're willing to sell so cheap sometimes. They just want to be done with it.
Okay.
Well, I was an appraiser as well, so obviously that was helpful. But since you stole that one, I'll say I think my greatest asset is my ability to focus on something. And just block everything out, and I have a task in front of me, I'm going to just get it done. And so whether it's, you know, going out and finding a deal or whatever, that, you know, tends to be my focus, and I can't get distracted by other things. On the flip side of that, that's probably also my weakness, because I tend to be a lone wolf when I get in that mode and take on everything, all the jobs and all the work, and was not good until recently at delegating some of the other things, the minimum wage tasks maybe that could have been done easily somewhere else, and therefore could have been a lot more productive quicker.
Okay. I'm curious, office outside of the home, And employees, how many?
I came from a business where I had many employees. I had many issues. I had workers' comp. I had all the different taxes. So I really, this time, I tried to create a business where I don't really have to deal with a lot of that. So obviously, it would be, subs. Office work, I do have an assistant, and it's remote. I work out of my home office, which...
Okay.
It's a plus and a negative. I'm debating whether I'm going to be changing that just because of the, different distractions. And
It's also hard to turn it off.
It is.
I used to work at home for a long time till 1996, and that did become an issue because I was willing to put a deal together at midnight. Right. If that phone rang, man, I was answering it because you never knew what would happen. But what I did is I put an actual keyed lock in the office inside the house where you couldn't get in without like a front door lock. And I had to make a mental decision, go to work. And it made me pause and think, no, this is family time. So that was one of the things that I did that was a big help when I stayed in the house.
Yeah, that's a good idea. But interruptions are there. I do a lot of, just Dropbox and a lot of the technology to kind of, run an office, but not necessarily in the same place.
Okay. Steve, what about you?
Both my dad and I work from our house. We're very anti having an office because we're in this business for the freedom. I'm not a morning person, so don't call me before 10 in the morning. But
that's what you consider morning?
I had to wake
Mike?
Up very early today, so... We don't want an office, and we have all our employees work from their car or from their own office. Or
when you say your employees, do they work for you or they work
with you? Well, they're independent contractors that work with us, yes.
Okay, but you don't have a payroll?
No payroll, no.
Okay. Rick?
I work at home, and I did at one point, I wanted to have a huge appraisal business, so I had an office, I had employees, I had workers' comp, I had payroll taxes, I had a CPA doing my tax returns for these employees, I had quarterly employee statements, a monthly employee statement. I didn't like any of that, so I don't have any employees. We do have one person that helps us very part-time. She just takes the repair calls and stuff, and she, we pay her just a fixed amount each month, and she doesn't work any fixed hours or anything like that. She basically just takes calls and emails when they come in and deals with the repairs. And that's just the way I go. I like a simple, easy life, and I've noticed that with employees, you don't have that necessarily. So that's just not for me.
Okay.
But I'm not going to get to the level that these guys are going to get to, but I don't really want to get to that level.
We don't have any employees. No one said they have anybody employees
this
yet.
This guy has employees. This guy has, work crews and stuff.
Well, yeah, but that's okay. Doug, what about you?
I worked out of the house for the first 4 years, and, I have three kids, 10, 8, and 4, which, 4 years ago it was 0.
Yeah.
And so, I love it. I love working from home. It became a little bit too challenging. I needed a place to focus because I like to focus. And got an office space about a year ago. And since then, we now have 2 full-time employees. So it's nice to have a place for one of them. One of them works there full-time to go to. And also have a part-time person who deals with management calls on the rental side. So for us, it's been a very positive thing in terms of production. We've really kind of kicked it up in the last year and a half. And so now we have an office space that we rent.
Okay. What percentage of your buys come from past relationships?
Probably fewer and fewer deals. I started buying REOs back in 2008 was the first purchase. And so I've developed, listening to a lot of the training from a lot of people, including the boot camp, and so made relationships with REO agents, people that control inventory, and so that worked really good, and I still get calls on properties that are going to be listed or problem properties that have been in and out of escrow a few times. So I always get a shot at some of those deals. But it seems like that's probably not as many and kind of dropping.
Okay.
In quantity.
Steve?
I sure miss dealing with REO agents. You just had to grunt a couple times and you got the deal pretty much. But I think it's probably 25% of our business or less right now.
Okay.
So.
All right.
What was the question?
What was the question? What percentage of your deals? You're old. You can't remember.
No.
What percentage of the deals came from past relationships?
For me, right now, it's probably 100%. I have a kind of a unique situation that most people don't. I get people calling me for comps all the time, and they're usually borrowers for the Norris Group. So I'll comp something for them, and then I'll just kind of, hey, what do you plan on doing with that? And if they're wholesaling it, I'll take that. And I'm also in a spot where whenever they have something, a lot of times people approach me. I get this all the time. Like, hey, I got this thing in blah, blah, blah. You know, do you know some? I just had one. The guy had one in Apple Valley. And he says, hey, I got this one in Apple Valley. Do you know anybody that would buy this? And I literally told him, yeah, Justin Williams will take that. Doug Van Soest will take that. Send that over to Steve Landis. And oh, by the way, if none of those guys want to sell it, I'd give you 90 grand for it. And I really don't care if I buy it or not, and I think he kind of gets that, too. So he probably called these guys, and they were all below 90, and he called me back and said, okay, well, you can have it for 90. And I put very little effort into that, and I literally gave this guy the comps. Like, he thought it was worth 120, and I told him, you know what, I just sold one over there, and I think you can get 135, and I sent him over to him. And I really didn't care if I bought that one or not. I mean, I want it, but if I don't get it and he sells it to Doug, you know, no big deal. But the guy knows I'm going to close fast, and he knows I'm going to, you know, he knows I'm being honest with him, and he said I can have it. And I think he's only making like $2,000 on it, but he just wants that house to leave his life. So that's how I get 100% of my stuff now is that situation. I do some your way too, so you're on the list. Somebody just told me, I got a bunch of stuff coming up in like Marietta, and I told them, well, why don't you have Bruce take a look at that, or Greg? I mean, they're buying that stuff.
Uh-oh.
Dude, I give your name out all the time, and you still owe me a deal. You put me in escrow with one deal, and then you cancel.
I see they know each other, huh? I forgot the question now.
How many percentage of deals, right?
Yeah.
Getting old. From relationships. Right now, we do mostly direct to seller, so that's probably 80% of our deals, but the other 20% is from some kind of form of relationship.
Okay, and it's usually a wholesale opposed to an agent?
It's usually a wholesaler that I've worked with in the past or has wholesaled me something, but still occasional agent will call. Maybe one to two deals a year will be from an agent.
Okay. Why are sellers saying yes to these wholesale offers?
I really try to find out what their needs are first, immediately make a decision whether I'm going to be able to help them or not. If I am not going to help them, then I, you know, refer them to somebody else. But if I am able to help in accomplishing what they're looking for, then, you know, it's just a matter of trust. You know, they're really listening to what I have to say. I ask many questions. I think we're, you know, all kind of in the same boat as of what you do to really serve the needs of that seller. I'm in no way an expert at this. You know, I prefer REOs. It was a much more automated way of buying, but, you know, we have to adapt to the change. And it has been, actually, at first it was very scary going from, you know, just something very simple, which it was typically emails with an REO agent or somebody that controls inventory, to now dealing with an actual person. So it was a huge change that, you know, I had limitations. I did the best I could in adapting to that, and it's been working really good. And now I'm actually no longer scared to answer that phone call.
Do you consider yourself a great negotiator? Or do you have the ability to get people to trust you, or both?
I think it's both. I think there is really not going to be a deal or a negotiation unless they really trust you. They really see, you know, that, because they get, I mean, I think almost every time I talk to a seller, you know, it's like, you know, I have your offer and 10 other ones, or I have your postcard or car or letter and 10 other ones. So, you know, I don't, and of course they don't want to sell. That's what they always say.
Right.
So I think it's a connection. I have to find a way to connect. And then, you know, there is really no pressure. This week I got two calls on deals that I probably had the first contact 4 or 5 months ago. And
wow.
Until now they just called and we're in escrow. So.
Okay. Steve?
What was the question again?
When you deal with directly with sellers, why are they saying yes to offers that are low?
I think it depends what kind of sellers you're looking for. So we're typically looking for distressed landlords, and they're typically accepting our offer because of their tenant situation. So a lot of times we're giving them comfort. We can deal with bad tenants. We've done it before. We're comfortable with that. We'll take it as is. So a lot of our sellers are dealing with long-standing tenant problems that
like relatives?
Relatives, non-payers, all the usual stuff that
Okay. They're
just so uncomfortable with. And we tell them we have 150 of those same bad tenants. We know what you're feeling. Let us deal with it, and you'll be in good shape. So,
okay. Rick?
I don't buy from private sellers anymore, but from 2002 to about 2007, that's all we did. We were sending out probably between 5,000 and 10,000 letters a month, just constantly. And I used to buy a lot of that, and it was always problem properties, problem occupants. A lot of time the occupants were their relatives. And usually, and I'm not, I'm like the opposite of Mike. Like, I don't have the ability to build great rapport. I'm not a real great negotiator. I'm a cut to the chase, you know. Okay, you got this. All right, I understand that. You know, what are you looking for? And I will get them an offer within a day or two. And a lot of times they'll have those 10 other letters, and they'll call the 10 people, and they'll get one offer, and it'll be mine.
Okay.
And a lot of times they would just sell me the house because that's the other thing. I would almost lead with that thing that you said, well, how come you're not listening with the realtor, you know? And I'm almost convincing them, well, you should list this with a realtor. You know, I'm trying to get them the most money. You should go with the realtor. I have 3 or 4 I can refer you to. And, you know, at some point they're just like, no, I don't want to do that. I just want this thing to be gone. So a lot of them have a problem, and they want this problem to exit their life as quickly as possible. And I've been in their shoes, and I can empathize with them, and I let them know, you know, if I buy this, I'll take it like it sits. If there's some of that junk in the house you want, I will have that stuff delivered to you. I'll have my guys bring it to you. If you don't want any of it, I'll get rid of all of it. You know, I'll close when you want. I'll rent it back to your guy, whoever's in there for a month or two if you want. I'll give them a little chunk of money to get out in the end if you want that. If you really hate them and you want me to start evicting them immediately, I'll do that while we're in escrow. I'll do whatever you want. But the end result will be this problem will be out of your life within 10 days. And that's what a lot of them just want the problem to go away. And I've been that person. Just got rid of one in Barstow, and I wanted that thing to leave for 6 years. And every day I was like, I want this to go. And in the end, we finally got an offer, and I was like, well, this is 10 grand less than it's worth, but I just want this to go away, and it was gone.
Okay.
You know, a good chunk, maybe 50% of the time, it comes down to price in my world, even though I'm dealing direct with seller, because they're talking to Silvio, and they're talking to Steve, too, and they're talking to a bunch of other people, but the other 50%...
Well, wait a minute. When you're still going to be a successful buyer, you're not paying close to a retail.
Right. So okay. if I get beat out on price, then I get beat out.
Right. But when they say yes to you, why?
When they say yes to me, a lot of the answers that have already been given. I love to meet with people in person as much as I can. Can't always do that. But it comes down to building a rapport, allowing them to trust me, and I'm educating them on the process. Because a lot of these people that I'm finding, anyway, they haven't sold a property in 20 years, 30 years, maybe never. And they're scared to death of everything that has to go on. And so when I can explain how simple it could be to sell your house to me in, you know, 2 weeks or a week or 5 days or however you need, you can be done with this problem and cash your check. And that has a lot of the time been very successful.
What percentage, when you do mailers, what percentage are you hearing from?
As far as just a callback?
Yeah.
Well, it used to be, I started in 2011.
Okay.
I used to get up to 3% on a postcard, and now it's probably 0.5%.
Half a percent.
In the areas that I mail to.
Okay.
You know, I want to mention something that Doug said. He mentioned that he wanted to meet the peoples, and I heard a lot of people say they like to meet the sellers, and I've only met, out of buying a couple hundred houses from sellers, I met maybe 3 or 4. One of those guys towards the end was a wholesaler guy, and he was a real rah, rah, rah kind of guy, and I had to meet him at escrow and hand him the check, and his wife was taking pictures of me handing him the check, and in my mind, I said, this is the last guy I'm ever meeting ever to buy a house. That is just not the kind of thing that I want to do or be, or I'm just out of that, and that was, I think, 2006, and I just... I haven't let go of that. If I have to meet a guy and like hand him a big giant check, like clearinghouse thing, and he's taking my picture, I'm out.
Okay. I've never had that experience. That's
you're not missing anything.
Mike has a ritual. When I went to lunch with him one time, I said, "What's non-negotiable in your day?" And I said, "I don't want you to answer that quickly. I said, I want you to think about it." And he came up with an hour of reading. So you don't have the luxury of thinking about it too long, but what's non-negotiable in your day, and why?
It's hard to pinpoint one thing. I am very, I don't give up. I set goals, or certain tasks that I'm going to do that week, and I'm just very, very persistent. So I don't let really anything else deviate me from what I have to do, that day or that week. Reading is very important, and I have different times where I read or listen to motivation or books. I've learned a lot from that. So I think those two things are probably not negotiable.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a cop-out, but I have an 18-month-year-old kid and a 9-week-old, so spending...
And you sleep till 10 in the morning?
No, I hang out with them for a little while, but they sleep in, too. We've trained them. But
no getting up till 10 in the morning.
I'll give you my wife's number, yeah, but I don't know what she does. But, yeah, spending time with my kids is super important.
Okay.
I feel kind of bad. I'm kind of like a bum. I got nothing. But I used to read a lot like Mike, and I stopped about 2008. And one of my goals tomorrow that we're writing down is I'm going to get back to reading, because I used to be, I'm doing good now, but I was really good back then, and I want to get back to that guy.
Well, you and I used to, we talk years ago,
we trade books back and forth.
Right,
all
trade
the
books
time.
Back. But sometimes, whenever you're going through a hard time, there are a lot of books that were heavy.
That's
when you stop.
That's 2008. I'm reading all this stuff on the
Everything you're reading
Depression,
like was the end of the world,
Yeah. The only other thing
that should be right up your alley with the cup empty type of guy.
The only other thing that I really have always try to have every day, and this sounds kind of corny too, but ever since I've been married, me and my wife, over like 25 years, I like to have dinner with my wife and kids, and I very rarely miss that. But other than that, the only other thing is that I have to have a good night's sleep. No matter what's going on, you will not be able to buy that from me for any amount of money. So, that goes back to the lazy thing. I've got to have like 7 hours of sleep in my bed at home.
Okay.
Yeah, I think for me, it's also time with the family, downtime after the end of the day, dinner, and then just veg out time after that. Except my brain's been crazy all day, and now it's time to shut that down and just spend some time with my wife outside the business and my family.
So. Okay. If you guys had to start over, and maybe somebody here is doing that, what would be your approach? And what would you do?
Start over in this business?
You're starting over in this business. Not that you're totally broke or anything, but in other words, you're starting this business tomorrow. What would be some of the most important things you would do?
Just probably You know, I really don't have any regrets. I mean, I've the first thing I did was you know, try to really study the business and try to connect to people that really knew the business to avoid making mistakes. So I think I've done that prior to buying, and then just you know, as I go along every day, there is something new, something I'm learning. So I'm not too sure I have something that I would do different. You know, I mean, obviously, I've been doing this just for a few years, but
quite successfully, by the way.
Well, thank you.
All right.
I think I would take action and do what's important. Like, people work on their websites and business cards, but we're in this business to buy houses or buy properties. So, do stuff to buy properties and buy houses. And I would see what other people are doing successfully and follow their model versus trying to do what worked before or what someone else says was working. Or so I would follow successful people and take specific action every day.
Are you guys, I'm just curious, do you go to investment clubs? Any of you guys go to investment clubs on a regular basis?
Not so much lately.
Okay.
It seems like that part of the business has slowed down a little bit.
Okay.
Or I got too lazy. I don't know.
Okay.
One of the two. But yeah, I think most of the, you know, it was huge gains from attending investors clubs. That's how I, you know, heard your name for the first time, and that's how I met so many unbelievable people and so much free information from investors clubs. That was a great asset
okay.
to have to, when I started.
All right. Rick? Oh, I'm sorry. As far as clubs.
I think I've done millions in business with people I've met at clubs. And all of us are in a group that meets once a month, and we do a lot of business with each other, too. So I think it's really important.
Okay.
So you seem start over, and I don't know anything, so I need to get educated, or start over, I'm just broke, and I need to start making money from day one.
You're starting the business over, but let's say that you don't have to be the broke part, but you don't know the business.
I didn't finish high school. I got my diploma early, and then just went to college in Mount Sac. And when I was going to college, we would get like one or two books every semester and just study those books. And a couple semesters in, I kind of realized that I don't really need to pay these guys money and just listen to this guy reread me the book I read. I'll just go buy the books I'm interested in and learn that stuff myself. So the very first thing I would do is go to a bookstore. Then I would get, you had four like modules you used to sell on real estate investing. You had the negotiating one, and you had the buying systems. Mm-hmm. You had the foreclosure one, and then you had one that was, I forget the other one, but the one that was really good was the buying systems. I would get that. I would get the books.
That was the only one?
That's the only one I need, because I'm not getting the negotiation thing, and I'm never doing foreclosure investing. That is not for me.
Okay.
So I would get the buying systems, for me, was my favorite one. I would get that. I'd get the bookstore. I'd start going to the real estate clubs, especially I really like Bill Tan's club. I would go to that one. I haven't been to Iris's because I'm not a lady, and she won't let men in the door.
Oh, yes, she will.
I do... Yeah, that's going to happen. I do like the real estate clubs, and I used to go. And really, the only reason I stopped going, to be honest with you, and this is going to sound kind of weird, is every time I would go, they would constantly be hitting me up, "Well, you speak at my club." And after a while, I felt like I've already spoken to all the clubs. I only got a few things to talk about, and I don't have anything left. So I can't go without them putting me on the spot, so I stopped going.
Oh.
And the clubs I really like kind of folded up. Like, I liked, you know, I want the ones close to home. So Aaron Mazzaroli used to have a place in Ontario. That one folded up. Nick Manfredi's kind of folded up to, like, now he's just a few times a year.
I'm speaking there next week in the folded up club.
Did that one have a meeting last month or the month before?
No.
No, he went to an occasional two or three meetings a year. And I liked the Orange County one, and that one folded up. So those were my three favorite. I will probably be there next week. because Nick is one of the few that never puts, he doesn't even want me speaking at his club. So that, so I definitely, going to the real estate clubs would be huge. And then I would pick a market, and just based on that, I would pick a market, and I would start using your buying systems, and I would just start writing offers, lots and lots of offers. When I was buying lots of houses, I was writing a lot of offers. You don't write an offer, you're not getting a house. And no matter how much you want it, without the offers, and then literally 10 offers will bring you a house, so I'd be prepared to write 10 a day. And when we were really buying heavy in 2008, 9, and 10, we were writing 10 a day.
Okay. And Doug? Doug wants to know how you get an offer accepted with every 10. I saw that reaction.
That's a great ratio.
Well, that's what we were doing, the same thing in 2008.
Yeah, one out of like 90 offers, I'd get a house. Anyway, that's a different topic. I would get your essentials course to buying. I was thinking the same thing. The reason is that's what I did, and it was a great starting material. Just gives you the general education you need. You get to hear Mike, you get to hear Tony, all in those systems there. And I would take massive action, get on Craigslist, contact everybody who has a house. Get a hold of every wholesaler you can through clubs or Craigslist. You're going to weed through a lot of people, but you'll find some real ones. Make a bunch of offers. Talk to every agent you know. Tell them what you do. Tell them you're trying to buy a house. If you have a budget, I would start mailing because that's working right now. I would go to clubs. Yeah, same thing. I don't go as often. A lot of them have shut down in my area.
Well, not Nick's. It's open next week.
Nick's is open next week, I hear.
You're going to have a great speaker.
Actually, they asked if you could replace me. You want to do it?
I'm bringing in the miners.
So, yeah, that's what I would do.
Okay. All right, we're getting close to out of time. Wait, I want this one question I might as well ask. I ask the women, I want to ask you, what do you owe your success to? Because your success level isn't normal for this business. You have a lot of people that never do it. You've done it extremely well. So what's the deal?
Everything I've learned has been from people like you, people that's here in the room. Clubs have been a huge, I want to say, a path to get to the people that really know the business. And I was very thankful to avoid a lot of the mistakes. Early on, I did have a purchase, I think it was like in the 90s, my first purchase. And, I tried to rent, and it was, I think I did everything wrong. I mean, I had tenants that would move out after, 60 days and leave the place a mess. So that was, I completely blocked out real estate for many years. And coming back and buying the first rental and really learning from, people that really know the business, it has been a huge asset. I mean, I manage, we do the property management. Now I'm handing a lot of the leases, sign-ups, and meeting tenants to my son. So he's really been a big help. And so I don't really meet tenants anymore and just manage properties, 50 plus an escrow. And I spent very little time managing. I know that a lot of it is because the properties are pretty new. So I don't have a lot of, repairs. That's been all thing to, the people that are.
What about what you bring inside? In other words, do you consider yourself determined? You had mentioned that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I recently read a book that's been a huge help, and it's in my desk all the time, and it kind of helped me explain a lot of the stuff that I did that I just didn't really know why I did it. But a lot in the book is The One Thing, which my friend Steve brought, your dad, I forgot.
Yeah, it's funny. When I was interviewing, I was reading that same book. We hadn't talked about it, but we were reading it.
That is a great book because that's really, one of my weaknesses is I try to do everything.
Right.
And you can't in this business. You really had to, you really have to find out what you're really good at and spend your time on that. And the stuff that's repetitive, which there is a lot of that in this business, You really want somebody else to do it, right, so that you could really produce and be ahead. Okay. So that's something that I work on every day, because that is a weakness. And she's really, you know, in part of that book, I mean, it makes it very clear that, you know, you always hear, you really, you know, you should be living a balanced life. But if you really want to make a difference, you really have to completely emerge and really concentrate in what you want to do and devote the time, and you cannot give up. And that's, you know, especially if you're starting up, it is very easy to give up, because there's just too many obstacles.
Okay, thank you. Steve?
I think you got to surround yourself with the right people and just be determined you can do it. I know in 2008 we met Rick at a property, and the stock market was down a couple hundred points, and he didn't bring his optimistic side to that conversation.
He had the empty glass with him. Huh?
He said, "Are you guys sure? Well, you want to do this?" and all that. But as we got to know him better, like, if you surround yourself with successful people and the right people, it's great. And Norris Group took a chance on us, and that turned out good. Six years ago,
both of us.
I looked a lot younger than I even do now, if that's possible. So it was just great, and we're very blessed. So.
Okay.
I want to add definitely Rick Solis. I mean, it's been a big, you know, every time I would meet at a property for a Norris loan, I mean, the feedback was unbelievable. So it was a huge asset to what I was doing.
We were wondering why we weren't getting so many loans. So he's diverting property. I got it.
No. You got every one of those.
I'm only kidding.
Rick? You know, I don't have a lot of confidence in a lot of areas of my life. But for some reason, even as a little kid, and I don't know why, I've been really thinking about this a lot. I've always thought that when it comes to business, I could do that. I mean, I literally think I could sit across the table from Donald Trump and negotiate a good deal. And I don't know why I have that, but I literally always think, like, if I put my mind to something business-wise, then that business-wise is the only area. And I don't know why I don't think that anywhere else. But if I literally think, if I wanted to replicate, like, Tony's business, I think I could probably wake up tomorrow and have that going within, like, a month. I don't know why. So that has always been, for me, I probably overestimate my abilities and underestimate how difficult stuff's going to be, but I just go for it.
Just go for it.
I seem to have lost that, like, thing a few years ago, but I'm getting it back today, you know, after this. But I'm very comfortable in life, so I don't want to do that. I didn't even want to come to this because I was like, man, I'm so comfortable. I don't want to have goals and do all that stuff.
Rick is like a...
We messed you up. Huh?
I really want to watch Netflix and play World of Tanks all day. I don't want to be working out and dieting and riding hot bike. I don't want to. I'm very comfortable in life, but. I'm kind of pumped up after seeing that lady swim with the jellyfish on her face and all that. I'm in. So okay. I'm looking forward.
What was the question? What's that reason?
Yeah. Why you?
You know, I think you gotta find your reason to do it. Your why. And, I mean, you have to know what you're even getting into this for. And then once you determine that, to me, the most important thing is, you know, you got to get educated, but don't over-educate. You have to take action. Know step one. You don't have to know step five, step seven, step 12. You got to know step one.
That's
do that.
I like that.
You like
right.
that? Thanks.
Yeah, because I see people's seminars forever and books.
Yeah, you can... You know, you can try to, and for detailed people, or analytical people who may want to know every single step before they even jump in, you're going to have analysis paralysis and may not get anywhere. Do step one. Once you get there, figure it out after that. Figure out step two. But just take massive action.
I wish you'd have said that?
Yeah. When I got in this business in 1981, when I went to work for that company, I only had one assignment. Was find a wholesale deal, get a yes answer from a seller, and it made it easy. And I didn't know anything about real estate, so I didn't have any of the language down, but I was so motivated, I had reasons. And, you know, so I covered the world with offers, and I got chewed out all the time. I got 200 grand offers countered with $2 million offers. And, you know, other brokerages calling our office saying, Bruce Norris, he's just like a ridiculous, this is a ridiculous offer. We want to talk to the owner of the company. And, you know, but that I was there to get a property. I wanted, that's the only thing I cared about. And I was so motivated. And that 90 days, more successful probably than any other 90 days in my life. And I will never know less about what you were saying, right? Other than the one thing. If you own something, I saw it as a potential to buy. And I didn't take no for an answer. And it was mindset. And see, tomorrow morning, you know, I'm going to open with, after doing all these interviews with everybody who's been on the panel, you know, what they have in common. So that's the first hour tomorrow is what they have in common. You know, it's a little hard. We have everybody up here at one time to get to all of those categories. But Jim Rohn said success leaves clues, and that's exactly what all of you guys have done. And, you know, been around the business a long time. What's helpful is when you've been around a long time, sometimes you learn from other people. And so when you start writing seminars, you are including some of what you've seen happen outside of your own business model. And so it's neat when you're in the hard money loan business, you know, you're funding 20 or 30 deals a month. You're looking at that business model and what's producing. So you're constantly in the learning mode. And you see people that are taking, you know, project houses and turning them into fabulous, you know, residences from like what you, sometimes it wasn't as profitable as you wanted, but you still did the project that turned something lousy into something amazing. So you're always learning. So we'll take a look at that in the morning. I want to thank you guys for sharing what you've done today. And I'm sorry. What was it? What? Sure. What areas?
I'm in the Inland Empire. Rentals. I stay in that area. For flips, I really don't have an issue where it's at. If there is a good spread on the flip, I would go other counties.
Okay.
Same answer. We buy all four counties. I prefer rentals in San Bernardino County.
We're in the Inland Empire. The bulk of our rentals are in Hesperia. We selected that area because those lower income like areas fluctuate the most in prices. So that area literally dropped 70% from the top of 2006, and you know, that had the biggest upside.
Same answer. Inland Empire, High Desert, Little San Diego. That's my main area.
Okay. Okay. Well, again, thank you guys very much.